So our next presentation on this topic is Toward a Theology of Sustainable Aquaculture, Stewarding and Resourcing Aquatic Creatures, Restoring. Stephen Hall and I met at the Asabel Institute of Environmental Studies probably 35 years ago or something like that. And
neither one of us had hair then either.
That's right. And probably the last time in passing in the airport in Minneapolis. So I was ducking into the men's room and Steve was just coming out. You know how that you pass somebody and go, wait a minute, I know that person. It was delight. But more importantly, and to the point, he's been working in the aquatics area in a biology and engineering program at NC State in Raleigh, as you see there, the information, and working with his students in the aquaculture area. And we're looking forward, Stephen, to your talk today.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to first acknowledge my co-authors, all these very interesting names, Smith, Smith, Campbell, Campbell, and Hall, but they're all wonderful former students, three PhDs and a master's, so this kind of represents consideration of some of our work over probably the last 10 or 15 years. So I'm going to spend probably the first few minutes just explaining the title and explaining what sustainable and aquaculture are, and a little bit about stewarding and restoring. So aquaculture is the fastest growing protein sector on the planet. It is growing faster than even poultry, which is growing quite quickly. Since this slide was printed, it has passed beef. Beef consumption worldwide is declining slightly. Fish is increasing dramatically. So we now eat collectively as a planet, we eat more fish than we eat beef. There are reasons for this, most of which are fairly good. So this is kind of aquaculture growing. And what we see is that the wild capture fisheries, and depending on who you talk to, somewhere in the mid to late 20th century, many of the ocean fisheries were reduced in some cases to what's called economic extinction. Economic extinction is not absolute extinction. There's still lots of cod, for example, in the oceans. There are far fewer cod fish sticks than there were when I was a kid. And what that is you bring your boat out and you take your nets and you take your guys and you fill it up with fuel and you go out and you catch your fish and you bring them back. And then you pay your bills. And you bring back $10,000 worth of fish. Well, that's great. And you pay your bills and it's $15,000. That is economic extinction. Doesn't make sense to go out and get them. So what has happened, and of course some then the response is moratoriums. So a lot of the fisheries are closed or reduced. Aquaculture has kind of grown in response to that. At times, so Naylor in 2001 put out a paper on a whole series of issues that aquaculture had at that time. Some of those have been addressed, some not, but aquaculture has continued to grow during that period. And likely it will grow more. So this is the one where I ask you, of what you had for lunch or of what you ate over the last week or two, what percentage, most of that is from terraculture, or we traditionally call it agriculture, what percentage of that is wild and what percentage of that is cultured? So anybody want to take a guess how much of your lunch was captured from the wild and how much was grown on a farm? Somebody says zero. Sometimes people say, I had a little venison or some nice berries from the forest or something. Okay, maybe 1%. So it's 50-50 right now in aquaculture. It's approximately equal between the wild caught and the aquaculture, but it will go to about 2-1, which is still only 67%, not 99% like we are on land. But just kind of putting that in context, that is likely going to happen. And people will say, should we stop it from happening or encourage it from happening? And as an engineer, I'm sometimes a little less philosophical. It's happening. It's going to happen. The question is, can we make it happen more fruitfully, wisely, stewardly? So here are some examples. Anything that is cultured in the water would be considered aquaculture. We typically think of finfish, fish farming. So during the conference, I've been saying, yeah, I'm an aquaculture guy. Oh, you do work with fish farmers? Yep, I work with fish farmers. But it is also plants, algae, microalgae, macroalgae, bacteria, reptiles, anything that grows in the water is aquaculture. And all of these things are things that, and I try to get enough green in here because the largest component of aquaculture by biomass, not by dollars, but by biomass, is macroalgae, seaweed, which my kids love. You know, we buy it. It's good, you know, healthy and whatnot. On land, the vast majority of the food that we eat is plant-derived. And we eat some meat, and probably we should eat a little less meat. But I guess that was our previous talk, right? Or an earlier talk today. So this is kind of aquaculture is this entire array of species under different culture conditions, some of them in the ocean, some of them in ponds, some of them in tanks or raceways. And I would also note there's an awful lot of blue on that planet. About 70% of the planet's surface is water. Where is it currently grown? Substantially in Asia. And again, this might have shifted just slightly since the time of this printing, but basically the U.S. imports about $15 billion worth of seafood per year. We only produce between $1 and $2 billion. So we have, interestingly, it's the number two deficit, import-export deficit of the U.S. It's not a bad product, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it, but could, would, or should some more of this be grown in our area? And then I wanted to talk, so I'm dodging theology. Explain it. I'm coming backwards. So that was aquaculture, very briefly. What is sustainable? And I wanted to kind of get both the spatial and the temporal. So we often talk about the temporal, sort of now and into the future, but also sustainable should have a spatial component to it. In other words, for ourselves, and we often think about, can I stay in business? Can I keep doing this and not get overrun by some invasive species or flooded out of my home or what? But also for other people and other creatures, okay, for really sort of all others. Here are a few thoughts on this. Starting in Genesis, God gives us dominion or rule. Interestingly, the fish are the first thing in that list. So it's a list of, and it is the creatures and their environments. So Genesis 1:26, the imago Dei, the humans created in the image of God, are given this command to rule over. Now, what rule is can be its own discussion. Have dominion over the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, and the last thing is the land stuff, right? The livestock on the land and the creatures that crawl. In Genesis 2:15, we are commanded, and Adam, the dust, the earthling, as Cal DeWitt used to call it, us earthlings are called to Shamar and Abad to protect and serve that creation. And there is a sense of that certainly carries throughout the Bible. It is interesting that Old Testament speaks to water oftentimes with fear. They were desert people. Of course, there was this traumatic event that's recorded in the book of Exodus of the people coming out of Egypt, the sea opening up miraculously. It must have taken a lot of faith in some sense, maybe some desperation when there's a giant army coming after you. Okay, let's go that way. They come across the ocean. But of course, what's the next part of those lines is that this is essentially the most powerful organization on the planet, perhaps at that time, this Egyptian army comes in and they are washed away. So water is this kind of scary thing. At the Jordan, the priests are commanded, you know, carry the ark and step into the water, but it's flooding. It's flood, right? Yeah, no, you, Chilliwack Rivers, no, don't go, stay away, right? Nope, step in. Okay, Jordan might have been a little bit smaller, but also water seen as a commodity, a scarce commodity and a blessing. Psalm 23, of course, the Lord makes me lie down in green pastures. and beside still waters. Okay, and this idea is this idea of not that scary, dangerous flood, but rather the idea of water as something that nourishes and takes care of us. Fish are prominent in the Bible, New Testament, Jesus himself. He takes these two, the land food and the water food. And incidentally, as in many of Jesus' stories, he doesn't get them from the big dog, John. He gets them from some kid in the back, right? That has a little bit of lunch, you know, some bread and some fish. And then by the end of it, he hands it out to everybody. And, oh, there's more. So this idea of abundance is part of this. And of course, Jesus, even after he is ascended or raised from the dead, he cooks fish, he walks on water. And then I want to, you know, address, this was addressed earlier, John 3:16, we often think of in our modern culture as a personal, very personal thing. God so loved the world that he gave his only son that whoever, that if I believe or if you believe, your life will be changed. But that word is cosmos. God so loved the world, which seems to imply, yes, every single one of us, but also the rest of God's creation. And then Revelation 21 and 22 both have ideas about restoration. It's interesting, there is no sea, and it's emphasized. The sea was no more, and yet water's not gone. In fact, there's this beautiful river in the middle of the city. So wherever Edward went, yeah, the city, but it's clean. Crystal clear. It's a really nice river coming down through. So I wanted to just do a little brief comparison between kind of this historical narrative in the Bible and perhaps some of our thoughts today. We are having impact, as was ably demonstrated by our previous presenters, human impact on the ocean and on the water. We are still called, I think, to protect and serve, and perhaps somewhat creatively restore. And each of you mentioned briefly restoration, but also that it's hard to restore. And so I want to at least put that in front of us as something that may be possible and maybe we're even called to somehow restore God's creation. This idea of fear, we're still scared of water. Big floods, hurricanes, run away. And you know, that's maybe wisdom might be okay not to get in the way of that. Worldwide water management, there are agreements in place, and in many places they are transboundary agreements. They're imperfect, but they are there, and perhaps they could be better. Certainly many, many ministries see water as both a very real physical thing that people need good, clean water to drink and to use, and also as an image of, you know, the Lord providing and a way to share the good news. Fish protein is still healthy and efficient. Jesus cooked fish and shared them. I mentioned seaweed. We might share that too. And we also can care for the human and the non-human. And I want us again to sort of think about that. How do we provide? You know, earlier we heard about, 8 billion, 10 billion people, lots of people. I, for one, don't necessarily want them to all starve. I certainly don't want myself or you guys to starve. So I'd like to be part of that. At the same time, how do we also provide for the flourishing of the rest of creation? And I'm going to just take a little inspiration from Revelation and say, restoration is called for. Restoration is coming. I think we're called to at least practice for that now. And also to do that without fear. The Lord is with you. The Lord bless you. The Lord keep you, and to enjoy that. So a couple of things that I'm just going to talk about. So sustainability is often thought of in three ways. Environmental, that's the one we always think of. Economic, if you can't pay the bills, you're probably not going to do something. And social, if people are not interested in doing that, or if this impacts human beings in a bad way, you won't continue to do that, or you will have bad effects. And then amongst the sort of details are things like rich and poor. And I kind of throw this out there. Somebody mentioned salmon. They are a wonderful fish. Very healthy, very good. Some are still harvested from the wild. Some are cultured. But those are relatively expensive. They're carnivorous fish. So you're feeding oftentimes other fish partially at least, to those fish, that doesn't sound quite as efficient as it could be versus something like a tilapia or other omnivorous or herbivorous fish. And of course, the seaweed itself is a plant. So, okay, that seems good. And I always sort of say, well, the striped bass and the sturgeon will pay the bills, but the tilapia and the carp and the catfish are going to feed the world. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. And then this idea of restoration of our ecology or oecology of our home. Okay, how do we care for our home? And then I'm just going to have a couple of mentions on automation and AI that I thought our speaker this morning was spectacular on that. So my thoughts on this are very, very brief, but I think that also intersects with provision of our food and care for creation. So recirculating aquaculture systems, I actually work with some of these. You can see me in one of our farmers. This is tilapia, grown very efficiently, almost 100% growth and success. They're efficient. They are efficient at water use. There are costs in terms of both capital and energy, and we're working to make those more efficient. And then kind of this idea of efficient production could allow our natural stocks to recover. And some of that is happening or has happened, some maybe not so effectively. I want to talk about FCR. So FCR is a feed conversion ratio. And someone earlier mentioned cows being not as efficient as chickens. True. And chickens are not as efficient as fish. Fish are very good at converting feed. So you typically feed a cow 20 pounds of grass to get a pound of beef. And those numbers can be in the range of 1 point something for fish. So, okay, something to think about. And there's fundamental reasons. A cow is 1,000 pounds, has to grow some big bones to hold up that weight. A fish is floating in the water. I mean, think about how big the bones are in fish. Now, there's still this range of these more, I'm going to call them expensive fish, where the fish feed itself is relatively expensive ecologically versus this low trophic level, trying to feed plant-based materials and produce efficiently. And in that way, I think we can bless others. And these are all my kids. I actually had a picture of my biological. Oh, there's a couple biological kids in here. But yeah, grad students and anyways, lots of. Eventually, you start thinking of everybody as your kid. And you know, that's probably not. That's probably, you know, I mean, when Jesus said, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor, he meant for us to think everybody's our neighbor. Everybody's our. And everybody, here's the other thing. He meant for us to do a little time travel. Everybody, including our great-great-great-grandchildren, they're all our neighbor, okay? Now, that's a little harder for some of us, but yeah, we're all neighbors. And I think the other creatures are our neighbors as well. So maybe I'm stretching my theology there, but I'm throwing it out there. We are working on a number of projects, coastal restoration. We do work with some, I'll call them higher trophic level, not so efficient sturgeon, bass, expensive type fish, but we also work with algae, macroalgae, oysters, tilapia, which are wonderful, very efficient. Oysters are filter feeders. Algae are absorbing things like phosphorus, not so bad. And we're training our students as well. Here's a little map of our little state. So this is North Carolina on the east coast of the U.S. And it's interesting because this captures some of the ecoregions. And we've got kind of a coastal region with relatively warm water, a Piedmont where there are a variety of ponds, and then mountains where we're actually growing some trout. We're the number two trout culture state in the U.S. So interesting, but a diverse aquaculture industry. And I run a little thing called the Marine Aquaculture Research Center, and we're doing a variety of studies there in some small recirculating systems. And one of our big things is looking at I call it resources, but people will call it waste management. But what do we do with those excess nutrients, and can we do maybe some good things with them? So, and then I wanted to put a couple slides up. This is Vashti Campbell, finished up her PhD in 22. She's in D.C. She is working on food processing, including fish food environmental assessment of genetically altered fish, aquaculture pharmaceutical risk assessment. And she also had some thoughts on the personal side about glorifying God through her work, providing expert counsel and truthful scientific evidence, and working willingly at whatever we do. So, and she thought of Daniel, and then the Proverbs 31 woman, a noble woman who can find she is worth far more than rubies. And then I have students working on some large, very large systems. So I just wanted to give this sense that there are these large systems. When things get big, that also means what else? Lots of nutrients are being concentrated somewhere. And so that either makes it better or worse, but if you don't manage those nutrients well, then that can make it worse. So on the other hand, the ocean is big. Each country, at least at this point, has an EEZ zone about 200 miles offshore. So there's a lot of space there that people might use. Matt Campbell finished up in 2020, and his little company is doing these environmentally friendly artificial reefs. And you can see they start out as sort of a weird 3D printer. We call it a bad 3D printer, but we got a patent on it, a couple patents, in fact. And then what they grow into is these biologically dominated systems where basically when you're done with them, they are very similar, and they're dominated by natural, in this case, oysters, but we're also doing coral reefs. And then just a brief comment on AI, because we have some projects on both drones and then little boat aquatic systems. And this, I think, is just a little take from this morning's keynote, is this idea of how do we, this is part of the NSF NRI, National Robotics Initiative, and co-robots, the idea of robots not replacing people or dominating people, but of robots collaborating with, cooperating with, helping humans to make wiser decisions. So this is part of what we're doing, and we're applying this to oysters and coastal management. So that's kind of the summary. Lots of practical engineering kind of things. But in the end, I want to not only, I mean, and this is like impossible. These things that are impossible for us are possible with God. How do we grow enough food to care for our people? How do we take care of the environment? And even raise the bar and say, how do we restore as well as care for creation? So I'll stop at that and take a question. Yeah, Matthew.
Hey, thank you so much. I think I get so excited when there's a theology of fish slide. That is so great. And I there's stuff in there I hadn't considered before, but I'd encourage you, you start with Imago Dei and Dominion. I'd encourage you to go even earlier to day four, where God blesses the fish. Mm-hmm. And that word bless, right? It's the first use in Genesis of that particular word, which is covenant related in the rest of the Pentateuch. And the blessing is to be fruitful and multiply. Yeah. Now, with aquaculture, you've talked about justice for the poor. I was wondering if you could comment on the ethical treatment of the fish. Yes. When they're packed into sea cages and these sorts of things. What should we be considering as aquaculture moves forward?
That's great. Great questions, great comments. Thank you, Matthew. Yeah, so ethical treatment of fish. So we have a thing called an IACUC in the AC is animal care and use, and we are required within our research to treat animals well, minimize any suffering that they would experience. Of course, most of our work and most of the culture work is intended to produce a healthy animal. So, I mean, you can't be too abusive. I mean, the truth is, of course, you would really like very healthy, robust animals. They are constrained. And so you sort of go, okay, well, chickens in a box, is that totally natural? Fish in a cage, is that totally natural? Probably not. So that's, but I think those are very parallel questions. So, you know, shy of that, I think I would say that for the most part, the desire in culture is to have very healthy animals. That restoration idea is, and maybe I'll tell one very brief story, alligators. So alligators were on the threatened and endangered list. There was a bunch of research and a deal cut about 30 years ago. You can harvest 100 alligator eggs from the wild. You can culture them. When they get to be 4 feet long, nothing can kill them. You have to release 16 animals. If you're good, you got 84 left. I mean, if you're not so good, you might not have any left and you go out of business. but those remaining animals can be cultured and sold. The upshot of that is today there's a $30 million business in alligators in the state of Louisiana. It is growing and healthy and robust. The alligator population has come back so much they're a nuisance species. They occasionally have to be removed from the lakes and the big cities and such and taken back to the swamps. And the marshes have recovered. And it's interesting, the marsh guys documented that and they didn't know what the story was. These things are eating the invasive nutria. And the nutria population fell and the marsh grew back, which is kind of like the wolves in Yellowstone. So that's, I mean, that's just one example and not everything else is at that point. But that I think is a nice example of something that could happen where you are both culturing something, providing a valuable product, and at the same time, actually restoring in a very real sense, both the creature and the ecosystem. So
great talk. Appreciate the fish theology point as well.
Sure.
My question is rich versus poor. Thoughts about what you've had to do in making decisions about which species to use in which parts of the world so you don't create an invasive problem with trying to feed people with quick produce.
Yeah, so invasive species, culture. Tilapia, interesting, are highly restricted in the state of Louisiana, but not restricted in Arkansas. And tilapia will die below about 45 degrees Fahrenheit, about 15 degrees Celsius. So, you know, up here, not a problem. Down there, and guess what? There's waterways to go between Arkansas and Louisiana. So, yes, there's concern. And, of course, some of the famous ones might be things like carp or zebra mussels. So definitely there is this concern about being careful. So a lot of those we have, like the legitimate fish farms have biocontrol. They have all kinds of constraints to minimize or stop that. Open fish cages, on the other hand, have been documented at times to have releases. And so that's, and of course, like on the West Coast, I think that that is completely, you know, over. Pretty close to done there. But worldwide, there are still sea cages in several places in Asia, Chile, Norway. So those, and can they harbor disease? And what about the nutrients? So these are all things. Now, people are thinking about these. And I would say I would, on average, probably both in the U.S. and worldwide, practices are better than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Could they still be improved? Yes. And certainly we would want to do that. We like to work with native species. We're working with a domesticated form of the striped bass on the East Coast. Even that we do primarily in RAS, recirculating aquaculture systems. So they're very constrained.
I work in Cambodia, so one of the concerns there is raising food quickly because the Mekong is being destroyed.
Yeah.
They're losing 70% of the protein for poor people.
Yeah.
But they're raising tilapia, which is not native to Asia.
Yeah, it's African. Yeah, tilapia is African. Now, the Indians, of course, eat the what they call the major carps that most North Americans don't really want to, but I mean, they grow well. And they are considered good food there. They certainly have protein and they grow well. So I think it makes sense to try to grow. And those guys actually have like substrains. They have little local versions of these that mostly we don't have. You know, tilapia, there's a couple different species. But essentially, we get our farmers get their baby tilapia shipped in an airplane from Africa or from Florida to North Carolina, plunk them in there. And they're the same fish genetically. That's absolutely part of managing these. Yeah. Thank you.
Steve, thank you. This is fascinating. I know Matthew wants to ask another question. I know on the West Coast and here in Vancouver Island, the salmon farming, those are Atlantic salmon that we were understood would not interbreed with the wild Pacific salmon if they happen to escape. So there are some real challenges. But there's also response. And so I appreciate Edward's talk earlier. We saw here this hope and restoration and change. We hear hopefulness throughout these talks in particular. Sarah, thank you. You're first person at the COP 27 events. Get the number right. I mean, this has been a very hopeful series of talks. And all about aquatics. And I think you'll all agree with me the scripture says in Proverbs that iron sharpens iron, as one friend sharpens another. And I think water has a way of shaping and forming. And your watery talks have helped shape us and form us. And we will all agree, though, that none of you are all wet.